This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
I'd like to think that she got her grand piano. I mean, I'm an optimist here. I don't know what she would have done with it. I mean, she was going to be in there for a while. I don't know what her sentence was, but I'd like to think that Donna would follow through a little bit.
You know, I would think the grand piano, the dimensions of it are probably twice as large as some of the dimensions within a jail cell. You know, probably not going to be doing any concertos inside those jail walls at anytime soon.
What an odd thing, right?
You put it in the cell and then you have levels. Then you can go on top of the levels, Jerry. Mm-hmm. Levels. You're building the apartment in levels. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to think of Donna. Like, what are the logistics? How are you going to get, number one, moving a grand piano is hell. It's like a pool table. You just kind of leave it where you're at half the time. Like, enjoy the piano.
Was this for when she got out of prison? I mean, I'd love to know the details of this. Like, how does this go down? I mean,
yeah, you know, I'm not sure Donna had thought out all of these details. What it strikes me as, like I said, is someone who is kind of a fish out of water, doesn't know what to do. I have this money and stuff. Let me make some desperate offer to these people to kind of save my behind. And I think the people are saying, hey, this lady is detached from reality. I'm going to exploit that for my own gain.
I wonder if Donna ever had any intent of sending the grand piano, or if this was a situation where they were both playing each other and they both knew, like Donna knew she was playing these people. I'm going to say whatever I need to say. Oh, Harvey will help get you the drugs. This will happen over here. You're going to get money. Everything's going to be lovely. And she's just saying whatever she needs to say to survive and think that she's going to convince these people to testify for her. And then, you know, after that, screw you. I'm free. I don't need to do anything for you. You're a convict behind bars. And at the same time, they were planning to play her simultaneously. That kind of feels like how this went. And they both, the only one that like really, I think, thought that maybe she was going to get away with it was Donna.
Yeah, I hear you. I agree that I think Donna, you know, really strikes me as, and in fact, much of the Adelson families kind of strikes me as people who think they're untouchable. They have this wealth. They've developed some influence and power in their community, and they think they can kind of just do whatever. They can orchestrate this murder for hire plot. They're not going to get caught. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of have these delusions. And then when you look at the real world of criminal justice, to which they have not probably been exposed in any great depth, that's a harsh harsh realization. And the harshest realization came down with the jury verdict of guilty.
This was certainly a case, as Georgia put it. I mean, it's death by a thousand cuts. And one of those cuts was Dan Markell's license plate number being scribbled down on Donna's 2014 planner. How do seemingly small details like that help to eliminate reasonable doubt in a case like this for a jury?
I think there are a number of ways. One is that it's corroborative of the prosecution's theme that Donna was overly controlling. She was overly involved, personally enmeshed in this child custody dispute for her grandchildren. It's such that she would go to these great lengths. And when you look at her writing down the license plate, there was other testimony that she was sort of tracking Dan Markell's whereabouts. Who in the world does that to, for their, you know, son-in-law, even if you don't like them, without some nefarious purpose? And tracking those whereabouts, we sort of learned through other testimony, could have been some measure taken to try to blame this on Wendy's boyfriend, who also testified. You know, they're trying to align where someone is going to be, what the vehicles involved are, and that's a good way to sort of build a fabrication that someone else did this.
It feels like they were building their fabrication by playing Mad Libs, though. I mean, this does not feel like it was very well thought out. It feels like, as we go along here, oh, Wendy, you're dating somebody? Oh, well, break up with them and then act like you're going to get back together and ask where he was this day. And then that's our narrative. That it was him. He must have driven by, decided to stop off and murder your ex-husband. I mean, this the planning here is horrendous in terms of
planning.
I mean, it doesn't even feel like planning. It's more like what's going on today and how can we kind of make these puzzle pieces fit together? There didn't seem to be any sort of afterthought of, okay, Dan Markell is murdered. Now what? Did they have, do you think there was anything here that was just completely overlooked or that they completely overlooked and really poorly brought to the table in terms of their story?
You know, I think sophisticated criminals, the Adelsons are not. You know, they didn't plan this out the way that I've seen other cases be planned out by the defense. And, you know, one thing I'm wondering is if they thought that they were insulated by the barrier they tried to impose between the Adelsons and then McDemois and the killers on the other side. You know, I think they tried to kind of erect a wall. There wasn't a ton of communication, if any, between Donna Adelson and the killers. And so I thought, you know, maybe they thought, hey, we've got this on lock. We're good. But criminal investigation and digital forensics and people, you know, wanting to better themselves while in prison have proven that that plan was not foolproof. It was really problematic.
Eric, can I throw something in here? I'm curious, have you, as a defense attorney, been presented with a family as messed up as this or anything close where you're just like, oh my God, I'm questioning my life choices here.
Gosh, Stacey, good question. You know, as a former prosecutor and defense attorney, I've come across a number of family affairs in the criminal justice system. That's not terribly uncommon. You know, oftentimes family wants to come to the aid of one another. Somebody gets in a tight spot. They start engaging in desperate measures to protect that person. I'm not sure I've seen something involving multiple members of the family, and then also this murder for hire plot, and the manipulation and control that was evident during the trial on behalf of the Adelsons, and then also you put another level of kind of their arrogance, their thought that they're untouchable, they're not going to get caught for this. I've certainly seen similar cases, but this one's right up there with a conspiring family who got caught.
Let me ask you this.
At least multiple members have been caught. We'll see how the rest of this.
Exactly. Well, and we'll get to that shortly.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How important is image in court? Obviously, you can't necessarily completely control the image that the prosecution is going to bring at you. All you can do is control what you have. One of those things being yourself, like literal your physical self in that courtroom. We've seen all different variations of this over the years with different defendants looking this way, looking that way, sometimes looking dramatically different than they did even the day before. Let's just start there. Before we start analyzing Donna's appearance in court and how she played to that jury, just how important is that in your own experience, Eric?
You know, I think it's critically important, Tony. In every trial I've had, the jury is focused on a lot. They're focused on the prosecutor. They're focused on the lawyers. They're focused on the judge. But you better believe they are laser focused on that defendant. They are watching. They're seeing how that person presents themselves visually. They're looking over that person's demeanor. They're looking at their facial expressions in response to certain evidence that comes up. And they are engaging that as humans will, because, you know, they have to ultimately decide the legal fate of this person. So all eyes are on that defendant. And it's so important for that defendant to be prepared and to have kind of a cohesive and reasonable and acceptable presentation that's not going to cause jurors to raise a bunch of eyebrows.
What do you think the plan was going into this behind closed doors when Donna was sitting there having conversations with Tom Petty and trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to play this? How do you think that went?
Yeah, so those conversations go different ways with different defendants. In this case, you know, I think that they really wanted to try to play upon sympathetic grandma. She's a sympathetic grandma, you know, and she's invested, and she cares about her family, and she cares about these children, and was meddling of sorts. And sometimes grandmothers do that. That's something we can all relate to. And so I think sort of making that presentation of Donna Adelson in terms of who she is was important. But then you have kind of these more nefarious pieces of evidence that cut against that. And I think the jury heard some of those things in the phone taps and evidence from witnesses and said, wait a sec, this isn't really the sweet old lady that they're presenting her to be.
They basically just put a cardigan on her and called it good. I mean, it was not very impressive. I was hoping, I was thinking maybe there might be some grandma sweaters. Maybe she'd show up one day with the banana bread, you know, and offer loaves to people or something laced with cyanide. You never know what she might do. But it really, I didn't think her look made that much of an impact. In this case, I think she could have probably done a lot better, quite honestly, in terms of looking like the matronly grandmother. But her reactions, that was a big issue in this trial. The judge scolding her, of course, at the very end, but that wasn't the first time he scolded her. He scolded her throughout the trial several times for her very verbose reactions to testimony. How do you think that was helping Donna in any way, shape, or form in those moments in time, or did Donna just keep taking a shovel to that grave?
You know, I think a better presentation for Donna could have been just really this meek little mouse, this scared grandma who's being railroaded by her government. Something tragic happened in her family, and now they're trying to place the blame on her, and she's just sort of cowering and small and scared and that kind of thing. But however, like you said, there was behavior from Donna Adelson that didn't square with that. She's having these outbursts in court. She's, you know, she's visibly reacting to what the testimony is that's coming out in a way that seemed, you know, not passive, certainly, in a way that seemed more like she was prone to significant overreactions, perhaps, by things that are happening around her. And so it sort of seemed more aggressive, in my opinion, and controlling, perhaps. And that's the exact wrong image that they ought to have been portraying.
So, Eric, question for you, and I guess it's more of courtroom etiquette. So the verdict had been read. I hope I have the timing right on this. And then she had the outburst, and then the judge admonished her for it, saying, you're not going to act this way in front of the jury. Why does this matter at this point? The verdict is in, they've deliberated, they're about ready to hit the road. Why would that matter at this point?
With respect to the reaction post-verdict, the reason it matters for the judge is that judge has a duty to kind of maintain decorum, to maintain the integrity of the court. Okay. Look, if the judge allowed these kinds of outbursts during the reading of a verdict, it would happen in a bunch of cases. And in fact, sometimes what happens is there is kind of a dissension among the gallery in the jury. Sometimes there are fights that break out. The judge can't allow that. He has to make sure his courtroom is monitored and things proceed by the book. And so I think that was really the judge's motivation for coming down on that outburst.
So it wasn't to somehow protect the jury in any way from her. It was just get your shit together, people.
I think that's a piece of it, too, because, you know, the jury has a very difficult decision in any case, certainly in a homicide case. And the judge wants to protect the jury from any kind of negative response and feedback with respect to their decision. They should feel comfortable as best they can in their decision. They shouldn't feel fear of retaliation or condemnation or something like that. So I think that's a good point, Stacey. I think that was a part of it too, was to protect the jury from you know, any kind of negative backlash that could happen from one side as a result of their verdict.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.